Tech!
Next Trekkers. Is that, should we use that?
No.
Is that a thing?
We're not to the next Trekkeration yet. We'll have to.
Oh, that's better. That's even better than what I had. All right. Well,
Starlanders?
Let's just say Nextlanders, because, you know, this is not exclusively a Star Trek podcast, but this week's episode of the Nextlander Watchcast returns us to our watching of Star Trek, the original series. Brad and Vinny.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Hi. Hello.
Thank you. Yes. Hi.
Welcome to the Enterprise.
Oh, it's good to
this
be back.
Enterprise. This is Nextlander Enterprise.
Yeah, I don't know. Watching this much original series has had the net effect of making me also, I watched like 4 episodes of Next Generation over the weekend.
Still a great series.
You know, do you know how much, like, I don't know if we'll touch on it in these episodes or not, but like, the original series does not give a single shit about technobabble or justifying anything that's going on. Like, just don't bother. You know?
I think there are some episodes where they're a little more invested in that than others, but yeah, I think up front here, a lot of these early episodes are just, hey, time travel for some reason. Hey, this other thing happened for some reason.
I think, if I remember, I think that was one of Michael Okuda's many jobs with Next Generation, was supplying, like, babble about baryon fields and, like, do you know what I mean?
Like, yes.
Tetramino particles or whatever. Like, all the original series particles. Is like, I don't give a fuck. We're running out of power. We gotta do something about it.
Well, before we get into today's episodes, which are The Enemy Within and Mud's Women, I want to very briefly extend from us here at the Watchcast, rest in peace to Nichelle Nichols, who passed away this past week.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
When we talk about the, you know, progressive bona fides of this show, a big part of that is Uhura's central role on the show, and Nichelle Nichols portraying, you know, one of the first, like, central cast black women, you know, on a major TV series. And while this show, as we'll see this week, has some very specific issues around, let's say, women, Uhura is one of the characters that I think ultimately fares best throughout the series, and Nichelle Nichols is a huge part of that, and we are saddened by her loss.
A legend.
I'll say, as we've gone on with this Star Trek Watchcast, I found myself looking for later age remembrances by the cast, you know, by people who were on the show, and always a kind word about Uhura, you know, that character, and the Miss Nichols who played her, like, always everybody else has some shit to sling about somebody else.
Oh yeah.
Something here and there, and these usually end up like, but at the end of the day we were friends. Always a kind word.
Yeah.
Never bad. I've seen.
I don't think I've ever read a bad story about Nichelle Nichols. Like, she was legendarily kind, especially to fans at conventions, you know, and, like, was, you know, beloved by the cast. And honestly, again, I think genuinely one of the best characters anywhere in the series, like, the entire run of Star Trek. Mm. So, there will be some more Uhura-focused episodes coming up. We have not really gotten to the meat of her character yet, but I look forward to watching those. For now, we now come to the episodes 5 and 6. We are starting here with The Enemy Within. The hammiest of all hammy William Shatner performances.
Oh my god. Like before, I think before even the end of the cold open, I was just like, oh my god, the high camp in this episode is going to be off the charts. I was not disappointed.
It extremely is.
So I when I read the description, the tagline for this one. So I've got the osmosis knowledge of Star Trek original series, right? I've seen animated GIFs, I've seen whatever. I thought this was going to be the goatee one. Like, I thought this was like,
is a mirror universe.
Yeah, universe is like a whole other thing, right? I don't know much about it either, but isn't it like, that's like a running thing, isn't it?
It is. So they never touch on it really in Next Generation, but it comes up at least once. I want to say maybe twice in this series. And then DS9 and Enterprise both had some extended mirror universe chicanery going on. But yeah, mirror universe is literally evil versions of every character.
Okay.
It's like alternate universe.
So we got...
I don't mean to harp on Next Generation so much. It's just most of my Star Trek experience. I've seen there's like a graphic novel of Next Generation in the mirror universe. You should really look it up sometime, because Picard wears a fucking tank top uniform.
Oh, he's hell
like
yes.
Super, he's super muscled, like his arms are like, just go look this up. He's like, he's a complete asshole wearing a Federation uniform with the sleeves cut off.
Do they give him like a little like shitty French goatee too?
I'm not sure, but he definitely looks very evil.
Does he have hair?
I've really got to, you should look for some images of this. It's hilarious.
I'll go search DVR.
Oh my God. No, he does absolutely
have a huge...
What the fuck?
I knew it.
I'm sorry. I don't know if you can see Slack. I'm just going to put an image in there. This is so far afield of anything we're actually here to talk about. But
doesn't matter. I want to see it.
Amazing.
I love to see it.
You're not ready for this.
Oh, yeah. That's a really good... he looks like a biker.
Look at...
Oh, my God. Wow. Yeah. Straight up, like, he looks like the dad from American Chopper.
Yeah.
He's extremely... Data is a Borg? Like, Data's got a bunch of Borg implants. Counselor Troy appears to be wearing leather.
Yeah, Data is like the most Marvel Comics he has ever looked in on this. And yeah, like they, you know, honestly, like Troy, they definitely dress her up in some outfits over the years. They didn't do a lot other than just really enhance, you know, let's just say certain parts of her.
Like her hair.
We're not going to the Mirror Universe this time. We're not there yet. Instead, we get our very first transporter accident episode. We get
first.
Love them.
Oh yeah, this is a recurring trope in all of Star Trek.
Man, yeah, transporter as plot driver, plot element is absolutely a thing a lot.
Oh no, I was gonna say in this episode even like, oh, they need to get some more regulation with this transporter business because clearly nobody knows what the hell is happening with or how this thing works.
So the transporter. I mean, there are characters that straight up have fears of using transporters. It's people who have a fear of flying kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
They clearly have no idea what's going on with this thing.
Like even the specific transporter creating duplicates of people thing comes up more than once.
Yes, it does. So the actual plot here, and I'll give some background on this episode. There's not a lot actually to give for this one. The plot here is that there is an away team on a planet that is that sucks. It is a planet that is unpleasant during the day and then gets 120 below at night.
They never give a Celsius or a scale.
Yeah, they're not. It's got to be Kelvin or some made up thing, right?
Well, that's the thing is that past a certain point, with freezing, doesn't it essentially just become the same on the Fahrenheit and Celsius scale?
Either way, 120 below is too much below.
Yeah, I don't know what they were doing with this. Also, I mean, we're getting ahead of ourselves, but the way they just sort of forget that those people are down there freezing to death over and over in this episode. It's 120 below and like they're what?
Don't worry.
They must
have,
be using some other
they
scale.
They could have just said like, oh, it's like 20 below. And that would have been sufficient to kill people. Like,
no, they've got their Starfleet issue blankets. Obviously, those things are really good at fending off the cold. So it's fine. Yeah.
It was fun to see that this is where the concept of heating up rocks with your phaser to keep yourself warm came from. I didn't know that was a running thing.
All right, well, before we get to all that, here's the log line is that on this planet, one of the very, I think this is a yellow shirt, not a red shirt, this guy gets covered in some kind of magnetic dust that
falls down a hill,
gets covered in goop, and then they transport him up, and that goop messes up the transporter something fierce, to the point where anything that is beamed up following, or beamed down, for that matter, from that process afterward, splits it into two versions of itself, the good version and the evil version, and this happens to both a dog in a very silly suit Captain James T. Kirk.
Kirk's hamming it up is number one on the camp scale in this episode, but that dog with antennae and a unicorn horn...
It's like a little dog sweater!
...is right there at number two.
Also, they are always holding it's a lap dog, and they are just kind of always holding the dog just
It's some kind
it.
Of terrier, I don't know.
Like, they just play it straight, like it's just a dog in a hood, in a costume, like you put a costume on a dog, and you're treating it like an alien, and nobody acknowledges it. It's insane.
It's truly incredible. And then, so, the last thing I will say before I get into the history of the episode, is the way that it is revealed that Second Kirk has appeared is one of the greatest all-time frame shots of any character in this series. Turning to the camera, just backlit, uplit, and just evil Kirk face.
Yes. Looking manic as hell.
Also,
first good up-close look at the eyeliner that evil Kirk wears.
Yeah. Yes. Like, oh, it's that like thin inside the eyelid eyeliner.
That exact, like that shot is literally the thing I wanted to come here and talk about because I almost fell out of my chair when I saw that. I was like, okay, I know what I'm in for here.
It is so good. It's one of the best single pieces of cinematography anywhere in Star Trek, if you ask me.
All right, give me some details on how this gem came to be.
Not a whole lot here, but I will say this. So this episode was written by Richard Matheson. And if you have heard of Richard Matheson, it is because he is a very prolific genre novelist. He wrote the novels I Am Legend, The Shrinking Man, A Stir of Echoes, What Dreams May Come, all of which became movies. He also wrote a number of Roger Corman's Edgar Allan Poe adaptations, like House of Usher, The Pit and the Pendulum, a lot of those Vincent Price deals. He wrote 16 episodes of The Twilight Zone, and, with a little bit of a synchronicity here, he wrote Duel, the Steven Spielberg TV movie that was his first feature film role, or feature film directing. He was inspired by Jekyll and Hyde, obviously, for this one. It comes across. He did not write the subplot for the crew members down on the frozen planet. That was added later, and he did not care for that. You're going to hear a lot of instances over the course of this series of writers grousing about rewrites of their episodes. And this is the episode that begets the Vulcan nerve pinch. It does appear before this in an earlier episode, but this is the first one they filmed where they used it. It was specifically because it was written that Spock was supposed to hit Kirk in the head with a phaser at one point. And Nimoy was like, that's not a good idea. I have this idea. Let's try this thing. This Vulcan nerve pinch, and had it proceeded to demonstrate it on William Shatner for Gene Roddenberry, and they said, "Yeah, fine, whatever, go with it."
Okay, because he used it in a couple of episodes ago, I think.
Yes,
I don't know if it was on Sulu or somebody. He took down when maybe it was the naked time.
Yeah,
when they were all running around goofy.
I mean, Matheson is really the most notable thing here because he is a pretty prolific writer and did write a lot of like great sci-fi novels of like the 50s and 60s, but. Other than that, this is a pretty straightforward production, it seems like. And what you have here is a story of, initially, of a ship trying to figure out why Captain Kirk's acting so wacky. Because, initially, they don't know that he's been duplicated.
So what I'm getting from, so far, with our time with the original series, is every episode kind of seems to have a moral dilemma and a technical problem.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Like, concurring at the same time. And... so the technical dilemma usually puts the ticking clock on the episode, and then the moral dilemma, they have to solve the moral dilemma by the technical ticking clock.
Yes.
I don't know if the original series lightens up on that over time. I have noticed they are laying the, like, the ship is in existential danger trope on very thick so far. It is literally every episode there is a timer.
Like, yes.
Both of these episodes, right, have timers?
The other one is a little less pressing of a timer in terms of, like...
You're right. But Mud's Women, there's literally a point where it's like, we have 43 minutes left.
Yeah, exactly.
I think there's a countdown in this one, too, right?
Yeah, the countdown
it's the crew.
Yeah, because while this is happening, they cannot beam up the rest of the away team, and they're going to freeze to death.
Oh, sorry, yeah, that's like you're right. That's less of a count. That's not a they have 5 hours left. That's more of just a general, these people are dying.
Yeah, get them the fuck up here.
But I was thinking back like that episode where their orbit is about to decay, and they're going to rise to the planet. That one's got a countdown. Like, there's a lot of, like, we have 5 hours left. We have 20 minutes left.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
yeah,
that
it's
is
always something like somebody's always breaking the damn ship. This seems like very higgledy-piggledy. Nobody really understands how any of this works.
Yeah, and in this case, they haven't broken the whole ship, but they have definitely messed up the transporter in a way that Scotty cannot immediately fix because he's not really even sure what's wrong with it initially.
Because they transported dirt. Like what kind of what
Please,
testing
it's a special,
did they do
special
on this
special
thing?
Kind of magnetic soil that they've never seen before.
That causes your personality to split upon teleporting
on a very clean axis, I might add, because there are very specific traits that each character embodies. And in the case of Kirk, the one that's walking around with the rest of the crew, it's still Kirk, more or less, but he's lost his power of decision making, his ability to think on his feet.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the other Kirk is just getting drunk and acting like a complete fucking asshole.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I feel about this kind of like end of episode stuff. The assertion in this episode that it's like the bad, aggressive, violent, evil part of somebody that gives them their like strength of will.
Yes, definitely,
and like the power of command, as they refer to it in this episode.
I have here an unusual opportunity to appraise the human mind, or to examine, in Earth terms, the roles of good and evil in a man. His negative side, which you call hostility, lust, violence, and his positive side, which Earth people express as compassion, love, tenderness. It's the captain's guts you're analyzing. Are you aware of that, Spock? Yes. And what is it that makes one man an exceptional leader? We see here indications that it is his negative side which makes him strong. That his evil side, if you will, properly controlled and disciplined, is vital to his strength. Your negative side, removed from you, the power of command begins to elude you.
What is your point, Mr. Spock?
If your power of command continues to weaken, you'll soon be unable to function as captain. You must be prepared for that. You have your intellect, Joe. You can fight with that.
For how long?
I mean, if you're thinking about this in mid-60s terms, I can kind of see what they're getting at, like this sort of notion of what is the driving force of man versus like what is the intelligence that we have developed over time. But they are, again, they split it on such a specific clean axis of you are all of these things or you are all of these things, and only when the twain meet do you become a person.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's a little ridiculous.
Yeah, the framework they establish is that your aggressive, violent side is what gives you your will, and then your intelligence is what allows you to, like, focus it and sanitize it, or whatever.
Or sometimes overcome it, I guess, yeah. Like, keep it in check. You guys mentioned the unicorn dog, which is great. The unicorn dog is great. But also, Sulu is on the away team on this one. Just kind of rolling with it most of the time. But one of my favorite lines in this episode is when they're down there and he says how cold it's going to be. And Sulu turns to Kirk and goes, "That's nippy.
That's nippy."
Yeah.
I mean, George Takei has got a real, like, even if you watch, like, interviews of him from later on, like, talking about, God, what was it, Trekkies? I forget which documentary I saw him in. Like, he talks like that in real life a lot of the time, too. Like, mm-hmm. He frequently has these really grandiose deliveries of, like, turns of phrase and stuff. Like, he's great.
But it's just the way he delivers.
Yeah, but all, yeah, you're right. He is very, like, just kind of cavalier through a lot. I mean, obviously, like, trying to keep their spirits up as they're freezing to death. You know, it's like, boy, I wish they'd hurry up with that pot of coffee.
Yeah, like,
it's, like, 60 below.
The thing is, it's one thing when they do that conversation one time where they're kind of talking around the gravity of the situation and just, like, talking about, yeah, could you send some coffee down or something?
Can you give us a status report, Captain? Temperature's still dropping. Now 41 degrees below zero.
You've located the trouble. It shouldn't be much longer.
Do you think you might be able to find a long rope somewhere and lower us down a pot of hot coffee?
I'll see what we can do.
But they do that like three or four times, and at some point, I mean, at least if it was me down there, by the third time I was having that conversation with the captain, I'd be like, yo, what the fuck are you doing up there? What is going on? We're going to die.
Yeah.
Like, this weird metaphor thing we're doing, no more of that.
Yeah, that's what I meant earlier. Like, they just kind of keep forgetting that those guys are even down there.
Yeah.
So you get some real Kirk going around the ship just being a hobgoblin, just going around being a real dick.
Yeah, and he crashes into sick bay and demands brandy, which, you know, DeForest Kelly very confusedly gives to him. And then he decides he's going to go sneak into Yeoman Rand's cabin and fucking creep on her.
Oh, yeah. That was not a pleasant scene.
No.
Just kind of forces himself on onto Yeoman Rand, and she finally kicks him out. She scratches him in the face.
Yeah, that's the way you are meant to determine which Kirk is which.
It's like a lot of visual shorthand in this, like the scratches on the face, the eyeliner, the Kirks are wearing different shirts the whole episode.
Yeah, and it's like, this scene sucks, and this whole thing with Rand sucks. One, because it the way they treat it by the end of the episode really sucks, but two, also just the way they're kind of, like, Kirk is sort of like, no, it wasn't me. You're mistaken. You don't understand. It wasn't me. It's just like, yo, she's having a moment here, man. Just, like, back off. Like, yes, I understand it wasn't you that did it, but, like, the way the crew is kind of treating her in this moment is not great.
She's in that, like, interrogation chair, and Spock and Kirk are there. There's a moment where she is she's selling it. She's acting very well, and she's like, this was horrible.
Yeah, this was fucked up.
You did this and did this, and Kirk is like, look, do I have scratches on my face? It couldn't have been me. And Spock, I think it's Spock who says, well, the only logical explanation is evil twin.
There's only one logical answer. We have an imposter aboard.
Yeah. What else could it be?
Well, clearly you wouldn't be lying, Captain Kirk. So it must be evil twin.
Now, I do think by this point they have discovered that there are two dogs, like the second dog got beamed up, so yeah. Like,
oh,
it's not
angry dog.
It's not an impossible connection to draw. Yeah. But yeah, also
I think imposter is what he says.
Yeah.
Oh, imposter. Yeah, yeah. It's just it's in 2022, it definitely played like, okay, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. It wasn't me. It must be an evil imposter with the, look, no scratches on the face.
It's especially telling because we're 5 episodes in here, and the 4 that have featured Rand have all involved either someone haranguing, harassing, or just straight up, like, you know, attacking her. And
yes,
I understand now why maybe, you know, in the end, I'm glad they brought her back in some other roles that were not just this, because the way they have her mapped out in this series so far, not great. Just
yeah,
not
when
a great
I saw this
thing.
Whole thing, I remembered when you said earlier that her treatment is pretty rough in the show. I was like, oh, that's what he meant.
Yeah. Like, yeah, her entire reason for being here is like an object of desire for Kirk to some degree, but also she has a crush on him. But then the way she's treated in just about every episode up to this point is like she's just the sexual harassment avatar, and it sucks.
She is the reason the ship needs like an HR department stat. The stuff she must be filing on her reports. I don't know how Kirk stays in the chair.
For real.
Did you tell? Yeah, I told him. What did they say? He said, I guess it was an evil imposter. I don't know. He said his personality must have split in half.
So
that's space.
After this, they start the hunt for the double, and they eventually manage to capture him and tie him down in sickbay. There is some real good, again, more face acting from William Shatner with the "I'm Captain Kirk."
I'm Captain Kirk.
The "I'm Kirk" scene was just like the apex of this episode in terms of the absurdity.
It's like, just so insane.
My ship, I'm Kirk.
I can't decide if like Shatner's like belly yell kind of voice is amazing or ridiculous or both.
I think it's both.
It's amazing. Do they always have a tough time finding people on the ship? It seems like constantly losing track of people on a ship.
So by the time they get to Next Generation, they establish technology that more or less lets them like biosignature everyone and kind of know where everyone is on the ship. Or
so,
if they're not there.
We're not at the point where they touch their shirts and can communicate
on
the symbol.
They don't have that.
No. Okay.
No, it's all handheld communicators.
Yeah, those are just sewn into these uniforms. The little flip, hand flip out hand communicator is what becomes the little comm badge.
Their Nokia flip phone.
Because they seem to have a problem with people running roughshod over their ship constantly.
Yeah, there's a lot of like later space magic technology that just does not exist in the original series. The shot of Bones helping the scientist crew member with his injured hand, and he literally, we talked about the spray bottles in a different episode,
mm-hmm.
He's literally just using a 20th century spray bottle on this guy's hand, like, misting him with disinfectant or whatever. I'm like, what are we doing here?
Yeah, that was pretty good.
Listen, the prop budget was not that high, and when we get to the next Star Trek episode, you're going to find out the makeup budget also, not this week, I'm saying the next one we do.
Yeah,
their makeup budget is not great either.
Well, I mean, even in the other episode we're here to talk about now, like the wardrobe and like guest star budget also, well, we'll get to it.
Yeah.
So
limited.
I think you said this a couple of episodes before, Brad, but McCoy has some looks in this that could kill a man.
Oh,
like, and the only thing I could think of was one of you guys said it, like, this guy must have walked right out of Westerns. Like,
that same scene where he's patching up the guy's hand. He's like, back on duty, crew member, I have no patience for clumsiness. The guy was injured on a relatively dangerous mission, and you're just like, you fucked up, get back to work.
Man, he's tough.
Like, I respect a doctor who has no pretense of bedside manner at all. Like, is just like, no, fuck you. I'm on this ship. Everything goes wrong here all the goddamn time. I don't have time for you. Just get it done.
Spray you with some weed killer and get back out there.
Yeah. So they eventually come to the conclusion that the only way to bring these people back together is, again, with the use of the transporter, which at this point is not really functional. And, you know, in the meantime, they're trying to fix the transporter. They're trying to figure out how to get the crew back up. They try some test transports that don't work out very well. Everyone's freezing to death on the planet. There are multiple conversations where Kirk is just sitting in a room, like, not able to decide anything, because we have learned that the nice Kirk has no ability to make any decisions for his own. Every time, like, there's a scene where Spock and Bones are giving him different possibilities for what could happen, and he just keeps agreeing with whoever is talking at the moment.
He's in threat of losing his command, but refuses to give it up.
Yeah.
But,
I also wasn't sure how I felt about that. I mean, maybe he's right. I don't know. I'm sure none of us had to have naval service to draw on, but the whole Spock spiel about, like, Kirk is like, I have to inform the crew about what's going on. And he's like, no, you can never look less than perfect in the eyes of the crew.
Right.
Or you can't command the ship anymore. And I'm like, really? Is that?
Captain, no disrespect intended, but you must surely realize you can't announce the full truth of the crew. You're the captain of this ship. You haven't the right to be vulnerable in the eyes of the crew. You can't afford the luxury of being anything less than perfect.
That felt a little bit to me like maybe a Gene Roddenberry self-insert line.
That also, yes, definitely felt some World War II era holdover. Like, every great military man has got to be tough as nails. I don't know.
There are also some good body double things going on, obviously, because there are two Kirks going around where there are some trickery with the shots, just some straight up body double stuff behind a scrim.
I don't think they fully dyed the body double's hair.
Or like the haircut, like the hairline, I believe, is the haircut doesn't even match exactly.
Yeah, some good wrestling with himself. Mm-hmm. You know, they fire a shot that also breaks the teleporter more. Is that what happens? Or there's a shot goes off?
There is a part where they are struggling with the double, and the double has a phaser and ends up shooting to kill, because they tell Kirk, like, you can't kill this person, otherwise you'll never be back to normal again. And so he has his phaser on stun, but then the other guy wants to kill him. It misses, it hits some piece of machinery on the ship that further fucks up the transporter and makes it very hard for them to fix it.
They say basically there's no way, right? But then somehow, of course, there's a way.
Yeah, they reroute power. That's what they always do.
So at that point, can they just not transport at all?
At that moment, they can't.
They said they couldn't.
Because prior to that, I was just like, could they not just beam those guys up and, like, throw the evil versions that get created into the brig until they figure it out?
Right.
You would think so, but it seems like at this point they just can't do anything until Spock comes up with a way to reroute power through one thing or another.
Yeah, it almost got a little frustrating in this episode, especially just continuing to think about people freezing to death, how much just, like, aimless hand-wringing was going on.
Yes.
Like, there is an awful lot of going in circles, which I, you know, is part of the point of what they're trying to write, but, eh.
Yeah, it's a bit much. There's also a really bad Spock line somewhere in there where he's talking about the split up of the different personalities, where he says, like, you know, I have a human side. And I have an alien side.
Yes, that stood out really hard to me. Of like, don't you mean a Vulcan side?
Yeah.
Like, aren't you just as Vulcan as you are human?
Being split in two halves is no theory with me, Doctor. I have a human half, you see, as well as an alien half, submerged, constantly at war with each other. Personal experience, Doctor. I survive it because my intelligence wins out over both, makes them live together.
But that's the thing, is that this show is so human-centric, especially at this point.
I haven't looked into this. I don't know, and I don't really care that much about, like, external fiction or whatever, but, like, I don't think the concept of the Federation really existed, or Starfleet existed, when the show first started, right? I swear I've read that, like, initially this was intended as just, like, humanity's future in space, not this, like, big multi-species collective.
Yeah, I mean, they get into it, I think, a lot more in Enterprise, which, again, is a show that is very much about the origins of human, like, faster-than-light travel and getting into space for the first time. I think they say the Federation sometimes, but I don't think there's any real concept of how many planets are in it or how big it is.
They definitely have only... Well, I shouldn't say they definitely. as far as I can recall, they have only responded to human distress calls and visited humans so far on every
mission. Oh, we haven't even gotten to the Klingons or the Romulans or any of the other major species that repeatedly appear in this series. So
yeah, every alien has either been an intentional or unintentional antagonist.
Yeah.
I was going to say they kind of figure out a way to get the transporter working, and then Kirk's wishy-washiness can't decide, is he going to test it, is he not going to test it? They test it on the dog.
And it doesn't work, because they do manage to fuse the dog back together, but the dog dies of shock because it can't understand what is going on.
According to Spock...
That's his theory.
That's his theory, that it was too overwhelming a merge for the poor canine unicorn.
Yeah. But then, you know, eventually they kind of get to the point where, like, the ticking clock on the planet is about as far as it's going to go. They're on the verge of death down there. And Kirk just simply cannot handle being separated anymore. Even evil Kirk at this point.
Yeah.
After they do a little bit of, you know, okay, he escapes sickbay and then goes to the bridge and then tries to leave them behind. That doesn't last very long. And eventually Kirk is just like... Evil Kirk is like, I want to live! I want to live!
I want to go back. Please! I want to live!
You will. Both of us.
I want to live!
Oh, it's so melodramatic. The whole thing is so ham-fisted with the like, good and the... id and the, you know, the whole thing.
It's ridiculous. And eventually he just drags his ass down to the transporter room, gives him a big ol' hug.
Oh, big hug to that gentleman or stunt double, whoever it is, he has got both arms wrapped around him and it gets a little tighter right before they teleport away.
A precious embrace.
Shot. Yeah.
But it works. They manage to fuse the Kirks back together. They get him back into his normal state, and then they immediately beam up the extremely frozen crew, who I'm going to say again, could you not have at least, like, sent them down some clothes or something?
Right. Well, they say that, this is a funny part, they say they tried to send them down the heaters, and there's like, they duplicated, but they wouldn't work.
Yeah, like, you don't want to send them evil clothes, dude. No evil blankets, please.
Yeah, no, the polyester blend would have taken over. God. Yeah, it's...
Because suddenly they have a thing that can duplicate things, start sending down, as we might get into next episode, send down some of those lithium crystals or something. Mm-hmm. Like, start duplicating everything you can.
Yeah, but then again, you don't want evil lithium crystals either, so...
Definitely not.
So, yeah, they get Kirk back, and, you know, they all kind of come back to the bridge, including Yeoman Rand, and Spock makes an absolutely wretched joke about... I can't remember the exact text of it, but he's just like...
I remember being like, it wasn't all bad, right?
There were some
really interesting qualities about that bad Kirk.
I've got it in front of me. I can tell you in a second.
It's just such a fucked up line. Like, why is Spock making, like, is that your human side making that joke or your Vulcan side making that joke? Because if it's your human side, stick to the Vulcan side.
I think Kirk, Spock was maybe a little like, I don't know, like that Nine Inch Nails video you sent me. Maybe Spock was like,
that's not canon, unfortunately.
No. It was definitely like, Yeoman Rand is like, get the fuck out of
here. Yeah, what are you doing?
Just going to kind of grimace and walk away.
All he said was, he said the imposter had some interesting qualities, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
I didn't even read that. I didn't even read that as a joke so much as Spock just being awkward. But I don't know.
The imposter had some interesting qualities, wouldn't you say?
It felt very much him just sort of needling her about the fact that, like, she has a crush on Kirk and there was that moment, and it's just like, that is extremely the wrong response.
I feel like they're just not giving her the chance to develop that, because I had not picked up at all that there was supposed to be any kind of romantic tension between them before this episode.
Yeah, it's not clear. Like, there's a little bit of, like, very brief, I want to say, like, visual flirtation, but there hasn't really been any, like, focus on that in the series up to this point, so it's just weird.
The sense I got from that whole thing was when he was in her room and stuff and all that was happening was this is an extremely awkward and horrible power play. Like, you're my captain. And like, you know, cause when he's in there, it says something like, let's not lie to each other, you know, like, you know, whatever. And she's like, I don't really.
I mean, I might have a little crush on you, but, like, this is weird.
Yeah, I felt it doesn't end well. There's no good resolution, even when he has reunited. Like, the whole thing is like, well, some of us are all going to, or this whole thing has to end with everybody just being reassigned to different ships, I guess.
I would think so. Well, she does eventually get reassigned, but by NBC, so.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. The whole thing, like, Kirk maybe needs to just go work at a desk for a while. Like, this one's not going to fly.
No.
Sorry, the teleporter kind of ruined your career, I guess. On this
It sucks because I feel like if this episode was less of that shit and more of just Kirk hamming up around the ship, it would be an all-timer for me. Like, there's a decent amount of that. And this is actually a fairly well-regarded episode, I think. I wanted more of him skulking around like a little goblin and less of him actually trying to force himself on crew members.
I mean, this show has leaned into sexuality in a pretty heavy way, so I'm not surprised.
Oh, Gene Roddenberry horny. We know that.
Yeah, and we'll get into it, I guess, now in this next episode. So, like, holy cow.
You still have not learned the full horrible truth.
I don't know.
I think you'll learn enough of it just by watching this show. All right, we're going to take a quick break here, and then we are going to come back around with Mud's Women, an episode that demonstrates the other side of the coin of issues this show has with women. We'll be right back. And we are back, and we are talking episode 6, Mud's Women. An episode that, if you remember from our earlier discussions, was one of the ones that was submitted initially as a potential pilot for the series.
Whoa.
Yes. Well, it you know what? It kind of makes sense to me in the sense that if you were to read the pitch of Wagon Train to the Stars, this episode in particular feels the most like an old TV Western of all the ones we've watched so far.
100%.
From right down from the, you know, sort of like miners on the frontier out in the remote, you know, the remote wilderness, right on down to the crew running afoul of a swarthy Irishman.
Yeah. Also, I just to follow on what we were saying before the break, I'm just going to say at the top, could not have been less surprised when I got to the credits of this episode and saw that the story concept was written by Roddenberry.
Yes, it was. The episode itself was written by Stephen Kandel, who was more a pretty prolific TV writer for, like, Hawaii Five-0, Mannix, Mission Impossible, all the usual stuff. But Roddenberry did an extreme amount of rewriting on this one, apparently, to the point where he took credit for the story when the episode was submitted to the Writers Guild, which, again, Kandel did not like very much. There's some notable guest stars on this episode, including the three titular Mud's Women, Karen Steele, who was a television actress primarily, but she also had a role in the Academy Award-nominated Marty from 1955. Maggie Threat, who was mostly a singer initially and then did some acting, but then she retired from show business in 1970. And Susan Denberg, who was an Austrian actress, dancer, and Playboy playmate, Miss August 1966. Who eventually just moved back to Austria and got way into LSD, apparently.
Okay, fair enough.
It was the 60s.
Yeah. Also features Gene Donarski as Childress, who is the lead of the miners on the crew here.
Oh, I guess.
Yeah, he's a fairly prolific character actor, did a number of movies like Airport 1975. He had a small role in Close Encounters. He has another role as an admiral in an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation. He played Izzy Mandelbaum on Seinfeld, if you are at all a Seinfeld watcher.
Huh.
And also, Joseph Stalin in Command and Conquer Red Alert.
Oh, what? Wow.
Yes.
Okay. What?
Yes.
When you kill one, it is a tragedy. When you kill 10 million, it is a statistic.
Oh my god, I have got to look that up.
Yeah, not exactly a lightweight. And of course, this does feature the first appearance by Roger C. Carmel as Harry Mudd. Oh, I'm sorry, Harcourt Fenton Mudd.
Harcourt Fenton Mudd.
Please, thank you.
So this episode opens with Mudd piloting shittily a little freighter to the point where he is about to wreck into some asteroids while trying to outrun the Enterprise. They burn out their power crystals trying to extend their deflector around his ship so he doesn't die. And they end up transporting him and his cargo, three beautiful lasses who are destined for some place where they're gonna find husbands.
That's it. That's the setup.
Yep. And this episode is a piece of work.
There is a... Okay. The first thing...
First impressions. What do you got?
Oh, I'm going to go back because I'm looking at my notes here and I missed one that I wanted to bring up from the last episode.
Mm-hmm.
I think the last one... Is it the first Bone saying he's dead, Jim, about the unicorn dog? Is that the first?
Oh, I forgot to point that out. Yes, I laughed out loud when he said he's dead, Jim, about the dog.
I think that is correct.
No, we got one in like the very first episode.
Oh, we did? He's dead, Jim?
Oh, you're right. Yeah, yes. When the first crewman they find dead.
The alien that was sucking the salt out of people.
Yes, that's
we got
right.
at least one he's dead, Jim.
Okay.
So we're up with that. If you're keeping count at home, that's at least two he's dead, Jims up
for
to this
the
point.
Dog. All right. Yeah. Sorry. Back to Mud.
One like totally random point at the very beginning of this episode. This really makes me want to go look at the original effects because like that chase at the beginning has got like, you know, there's some work to that.
Yes.
Like that ship. I don't know if they did CG for, I guess, I think they did.
They did for all the ships. Yes.
The redone external shots in this, but like, it's like a fair amount of like maneuvering that ship does. And you know, a lot of the motion control type stuff they would have had to do with models. I would love to see how maybe not great that probably looked in the original.
Mm.
If you want, I can start uploading some of the original effects episodes. I do have them stored on a drive somewhere.
It would be fun to see that sometime.
Okay.
But
my first thing that's jumped out at me was Mud's chest hair.
Mm-hmm.
That is just, it's like detached from the chest a little bit. It's like skirting the collar line.
It's like
there.
Trying to escape the chest up the neck.
It's oddly distracting, and that's saying a lot considering Harry Mudd's whole getup.
Considering he's wearing a Christmas ornament as an earring.
Is wearing his like pirate outfit.
Yeah.
That really is a serious earring.
It's a serious earring, a serious belt buckle. It definitely feels like just some pirate gear they had laying around on the back lot.
The earring is reminded me the whole time of, and I thought this was going to come into the plot of like Men in Black when the universe is on the cat's collar.
Yes.
It reminded me of like the universe hanging off of Harry Mudd's left ear.
Totally.
You know, like, oh, is that where they're going to hit the source of their whatever's happening? And it took me a while to kind of, I guessed wrong a couple of times about there's some glamour effect happening to the crew as the women are walking through.
I don't know if this is more of a commentary on what we've seen of Star Trek so far or on Roddenberry or on just the 60s, but like when they first transport onto the ship and all of the it's mainly Scotty and Bones
primarily
are like practically doing the like cartoon wolf awooga kind of thing. I was like, I genuinely could not tell. I was like, are they trying to do some kind of like old nautical, like mermaids tempting sailors kind of supernatural thing? Or is this just men being horny in the 60s and nobody gave a shit? Like, I really could not tell what they were going for.
And the end result ends up being something that's a little bit close to both of those things, but
yeah. Somewhere in between, I guess.
But, you know, our first meeting with Harry Mudd, who is not a constant recurring character, but he does show up a few more times throughout the series and on the animated series. So he's brought these women onto the ship. They were destined for some place, but at this moment they cannot get there because his ship got destroyed. And they are beguiling the crew wherever they go. The men of the crew are essentially, their jaws are falling open. And just like you said, wolf whistles and awoogas all around the place. And, you know, they're soft lighting these women very heavily to give them that kind of otherworldly glow. But mostly they're just kind of there. Like, they're just kind of there looking at guys, just kind of smiling and being, hey, what's up? What's going on?
A lot of slinking against the wall when they enter rooms. Yes, a lot of soft focus, and then just a lot of like slack jawed stares by you know.
Yes.
Can't do my job. Kirk seems affected, but now that he maybe has his other self back, is able to overcome overcome it as the captain would. He seems, you know, rattled but still in command of his faculties. Whereas Dr. McCoy, for the most part, is a babbling idiot.
Mm-hmm.
The new crew member who is at the helm next to Sulu is just gone. Like,
his
that
name
dude,
Farrell.
Yes.
That dude is just, I suspect he's not long for his station, but he's just out to lunch most of the episode.
Yeah, that guy I think shows up a few times, but he is not like a regular cast member. And by the time Chekhov comes around, he's just gone. So
he's the guy who replaced our ancestral Irishman who locked himself in the room. Yeah.
And also Gary. Like that is the cursed seat until Chekhov comes around, because I think all those guys end up either dead or just disappear.
Is that a helmsman seat?
Yes,
is that
that's a helmsman.
Okay. So yeah, they're on the ship, but we're not really quite, like, Kirk really doesn't know what to do with them. They bring them in for questioning into a room where we get to see for the first time this technology exists, where they have a computer lie detector.
Yes, which I don't think comes up a lot.
Was it a lie detector, or was it just checking against records?
I'm not sure. You tell me. Like, was it fact checking? Like, quickly scanning through? Like, that's not true.
I think
there was definitely some of that.
I think it was some records, but also I think it was scanning some biometrics. So I think it was meant to be a lie detector.
Yeah, because there's also that part where the computer notes that, like, half the men in there have elevated heart rates and perspiration and stuff.
No decipherable reading on females. However, unusual reading on male board members. Detecting high respiration patterns. Perspiration rates up. Heartbeat rapid. Blood pressure higher than normal.
The crew has the vapors.
Right. So this is where they figure out his lying about his name and you know, his record, and they pull up his license.
Oh, God, the card they bring up when they show his record. It looks like his fucking driver's license. It's incredible.
Yeah, his rap sheet.
Yeah.
And this is where... you mentioned the ship is damaged and it needs... Is it dilithium or it's lithium?
It's just regular lithium in this.
Okay.
Lithium crystals. So yes, this is where we learn that most of the power systems on the ship are run through a series of lithium crystals, 6 of the 7 of which were destroyed while extending the deflector shield out. And the last one is cracked.
Yeah.
So they have a limited amount of time with it.
So they kind of audible. They say they're going to go to Rigel something. Is that
Rigel 12?
Have we not been to Rigel 12 yet? I feel like that name is. Are there other Rigels?
Rigel definitely. When I heard that, I was like, oh, that's a frequent system.
Okay,
yeah, that's one that comes up a lot. There's about 38 planets in Rigel apparently.
Okay, that's a real star. I'd forgotten that. I guess maybe that's why they reference it a lot. I
want to say that actually a lot of the stars they use to denote systems in Star Trek are based on real stars.
I think a decent amount are. This was 12, right?
Yeah.
Let's see. There is a Rigel 7 from, I think, maybe also original.
I feel like Rigel 7 is like a recurring joke in Star Trek, like, parodies.
Hmm.
Yeah. There's actually also a Simpsons reference here about
okay.
It. Oh, yeah. This was, oh, yeah. Yeah. Rigel 7 is from The Cage.
Oh,
And both of the Menageries and a Next Generation episode, and it's in DS9.
Jeez.
Okay, yes. Rigel is definitely a frequent Star Trek thing.
So in this one, yeah, right. Well, Rigel 12 has all of 3 miners on it who take care of the lithium operation over there.
Yeah, I guess, and again, this is where I think it starts to like show its wagon train to the stars, you know, credits here, because... It essentially says these 3 guys just staked a claim on a planet and are selling all this lithium to basically anyone who wants it.
Also, not the first... I mean, the first time those guys walk into frame, I was like, did you just, like, roll over to the next back lot, wherever they were shooting whatever Western was there, and just grab a couple of guys who were already in wardrobe and slap them on
and
here?
Boots and,
because they literally just look like they were straight out of some Western mining town.
Here are some guys. Like, these are the most guys we have seen so far.
Like, later on, when you get people who are living on, like, far-flung colonies and, like, agrarian situations, like, they're basically farmers, like, on claims or whatever, they still at least try to make them look like futuristic farmers.
Mm.
But here is just straight up.
Well, a lot of the stuff later on is more like, here is a group of colonists that are trying to found a city, a society, you know, something on this planet that is not just... 3 guys who have not seen women in a very long time.
Yeah.
I feel like that is not a thing I remember coming up much in Star Trek outside of like remote science teams.
Mm.
And those are Federation people. These guys, they're just out for a buck.
So that information trickles back, right? To Harry Mudd. about
yes.
this. All the details, the three stakers over there, three very lonely men.
Just three, you're sure?
Yes, the mothers are healthy, fairly young.
Later, Magda, did you get to your communications man?
The head miner is named Ben Childress. The others are Gossett and Benton.
And they've been there?
Almost 3 years now, alone.
Perfect. Perfect. Three of them and three lovely ladies has Harry Mudd.
At this point, I was kind of confused. Like, the women seem in on it. Whatever plan he has going on, they seem in on what the original one was, which mostly amounts in their interactions as, we're going to set you up with husband.
Yes.
And the whole time I'm like, is there some other grift going on? Is there some other thing that's going to happen? But mostly they seem like they're want to be set up with husbands, and he's yes. going to make money off of all of this somehow.
Yeah, I mean, he's essentially the facilitator.
Yeah, so...
He's the pimp.
Right. And they're kind of going along with it because they are out there trying to, through their feminine wiles, put into place a coup on the ship, mm-hmm. basically. Harry wants to take over the ship.
Yeah, so the way... Okay, so there's a couple of things here. One, the premise of this is more or less stated by Eve later on, who is the kind of the lead actress of the three women. Where she says, I grew up on a farming planet. There's just, like, nothing going on. Like, I have no prospects. I'm basically there with my family and no one else. So, if I want to go get me a husband, this is kind of my only option. I mean, these are essentially mail-order brides is what they are presenting here. And the other thing is that Harry surreptitiously, like, contacts the miners without telling anyone else on the ship because right. he's heard what's going on. And so he gets one of them to steal a communicator. So that he can, get in touch with them and let them know what's, hey, are you guys horny? Because I've got a thing here that'll help you out.
Yeah.
And I think Eve was supposed to try and seduce Captain Kirk, but it didn't work.
Yeah, she broke down.
Yeah.
She couldn't
and
do she,
also,
it.
Also, she's like the least committed of yeah. the three. Like, she's like, I don't want to lie to people. I'm not interested in that kind of shit.
She starts she starts going in on it, and then she's like, I hate this. I hate this so much. And then, like, yeah. storms out of the room.
I hope you don't mind.
In fact, Miss McKeown, I do.
I was trying to take a walk, and I just had to run in someplace, you see. All your men were looking at me, following me with their eyes.
Yes. I'll have to talk to them about that. They don't do that ordinarily, Miss McKeown. Somehow, in your case, and the ladies with you, it's...
Probably just lonely. I can understand loneliness.
Yeah. Yes, now, Miss McKeown, if you don't mind,
I suppose you understand it even more. I mean, having to run a huge ship like this with so much responsibility every minute and having to be so careful with all your men looking up to you.
Well, it probably appears more difficult than it is.
I read once a commander has to act like a paragon of virtue. I never met a paragon.
Neither have I.
Well, of course not. No one is. But some people try to pretend. Do you, Captain?
Miss McKeown, I don't...
Oh, no. Just can't do it. I don't care what Harry Mudd says. I do like you. And I just can't go through with it. I hate this whole thing.
And she's got a real... She's having a crisis of conscience where she doesn't feel good about herself either. She is like...
Right.
She's some self-loathing starting to creep in.
So they get to the planet. They talk to the miners. The miners are
wait,
like...
Wait, you skipped a big part. Before they get to the planet, they're... their glamour juice starts running out.
Yes, they do.
Oh, right. I forgot that happened before they got there. You're right.
Yeah. In which part they... This was the most confusing part of the episode. So in this part, in my mind, the story is, oh, they're like either 3,000-year-old alien beings that are going to wither and die without the special gummy bear that Harry Mudd has that he gives them, because you see them start to revert with these, like, the makeup is like ghoulish, like this ghoulish makeup on them, except for the one lady.
Yeah, Eve, I'm going to say their way of making her seem less appealing is to make her look at most 5 years older than she actually is.
With maybe a rough night's sleep, like messed up her hair a bit.
Yeah, they basically just no makeup. Like the other two women, they actually put in like what looks like almost like latex or some kind of...
Yeah.
More of it, yeah,
like,
for sure.
Like they give them like aging makeup, full-on prosthetic-looking stuff.
Aging makeup, maybe not even when people put aging makeup on today in 2022, it doesn't always look great.
No.
This didn't look good at all. This looked like Halloween fair, you know, we're going to make you try to look like you walked out of the Halloween store as a witch, kind of. So, like, they had, like, maybe scars or something on there. I don't know what was happening exactly. Either way, by the time they were done with this scene, I was like, oh, they're, like, energy vampires, or they need some kind of... they need attention to keep their youth. And I thought they were kind of going for this, you know, ancient crone kind of thing, you know, like, oh, they siphon the energy from a crew. By the time we get to the end, it is nothing like that.
No.
But at this point, that's where I was with this episode.
Yeah. And the thing that they are taking is this thing called the Venus drug, which the people on the ship have heard of, but thought was only theoretical, but apparently it exists. Harry Mudd has it, and he's been feeding it to this woman. So it gives them, you know, like kind of an ethereal beauty, which is intoxicating to the heterosexual men on the ship who just can't stop falling all over themselves. But as soon as the drug wears off, I mean, again, in Eve's case, she looks maybe 5 years older and a little tired. But, like, that is supposed to be, like, you're hideous, you would never marry me because of that. And it's like, okay, come on.
I think one of the women screams, I'm ugly. Mm-hmm. I'm ugly. Also, the Venus drug is described as just making you more of what you are. It is.
Right.
It'll make the, if you're, what does he say? More curves?
What it does is give you more of whatever you have. Well, with men, it makes them more muscular. Women, rounder.
Rounder or more muscly.
You're a man, more muscular. If you're a woman, rounder.
Rounder. Okay.
Look, we just did Hunt for Red October. Vasily wants to marry a round American woman.
True.
It's like, this is a thing.
Yeah, yeah. So, they wind up, you know, they beam these people aboard, and they beam the Western outpost aboard, the mining crew. And Kirk's ready to be like, hey, we're from the Federation or the Starfleet, and we're here to buy some crystals off you for a reasonable government price. And they're like, nah, man, we've got a side deal cut, and we've got you. And that's where Mudd kind of enters the picture.
Mm-hmm. Slides his way in there, and it makes the deal. And so then eventually they go down to the planet, and they bring the ladies along, and they have themselves a little hoedown in the old, you know, the hut in which they live.
Complete with a fist fight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bar fight.
And Eve, again, is not 100% sold on this whole thing. Like, she wants, you know, seemingly wants a husband, but I don't know if she's really taking to the lead miner guy who is, you know, I'm going to say a stereotype of a gruff working class, you know, middle-aged man from around the 50s and 60s, maybe doesn't have the most progressive ideology going on.
His moves are pretty lame.
They're not good.
Doesn't have good game. Meanwhile, in the background, we should say, the clock is now extra ticking because they're on, like, their half-lithium crystal, and they say their orbit's going to decay in a matter of days, if not hours, at that point, right? So there's that ticking clock, which is, we gotta get these crystals come hell or high water. And this is what Eve has, maybe my favorite line of this whole episode, which is, because it just reminded me of like a temper tantrum of like a kid. Why don't you have a raffle and whoever loses, they could get me?
Why don't you just run a raffle and the loser gets me?
And then storms out the door into the storm that's happening, which is like, I had to pause and ask my wife, I was like, is she saying that she hates herself and she's like a bad prize? And she's like, yeah, I think that's what's going on here.
It's not so much implied as just it's the text. Yes.
It's just like, is that just what's happening?
She is repeatedly not thrilled with this whole deception.
Which when she storms out again, everybody's got their full, they're in full, hyper feminine zone there is going on. So they're at the top of, they just had their berries or whatever. So when she storms out, she's like, oh no, the guy, I think he runs out after her, right? To go find her.
Kirk and the guy both run out after her. And there's a solid, I'm going to say at least 2 to 3 minutes of people just running around in a fog machine void where they're just calling for names and it's all very confusing.
Yeah, she and the miner are lost in the storm and then they go back to the ship and like scan a bunch and kind of have to wait for the storm to die down.
It's terrible. Like, the only thing I can think of is, like, whatever they are throwing in the air in this set right now to make it look like dust has to be bad for your lungs. Like, whatever asbestos they are, like, shredding up and throwing up into the air to make it look like it's blowing, these poor actors are all breathing this in, probably.
Yeah, it gives you the same lung condition that too much vaping gives you. So, shout out to Popcorn Lung.
Also, wear a mask. You guys, you're living on this planet. Near sandstorms.
Like, finally the storm clears and they find them in his, like, hut by detecting her with cooking with a frying pan. They're like, we're getting a thermal reading or whatever. And then it cuts to, like, she's making breakfast in the cast iron skillet.
And she gives him the little tip of, hey, go hang your pots outside and that'll help clean them. That'll, like, scour them for you.
I kind of had a feeling of where things were going because the second that they are alone together, like, they go straight into old married couple, like, sniping
what
at each other.
What was that?
Like,
I don't
out of
get
nowhere,
it.
Just, like, talking shit to each other.
He brings her in. She's started, I think she's back into regular person, like, not makeup. I think she's got, by this point, she's, like, starting to... The stuff is wearing off, right. So the way, again, they show that is, like, less makeup and her hair's a little... But, like, he's such a dick at this point.
And oh, yeah.
He's already, like, he just saved her. And he's like, I spend all my life working out here. This is what I get. You know, like, the whole thing, yeah, they're just like a 90-year-old couple, like,
right. But
bickering.
As soon as they started sniping each other about, like, the quality of their cooking and stuff like that, I was like, okay, I see what's going on here. They are absolutely going to end up together.
Oh, yeah, these two crazy kids are made for each other.
I did not expect them to go full, like, Dumbo's magic feather, though, at the end of this. Like,
no.
Like, they, yeah.
It, like, was so lame.
Kirk shows back up, and, like, they get into a big argument about the Venus drug and everything, and then, I can't remember if I'm missing a part here, but eventually he gives it to her, and she, like, I think she takes it to prove
Mud
a point.
Has it. Mud is there, and
Mud is there,
got,
yes. Yeah, I think she, like, kind of defiantly takes it to prove a point.
He's, that guy is being such a dick, he's just like, you know, like, they make such dumb-ass points where, I think she says, you know, you want somebody who looks good or somebody who could clean or cook well?
Do you want a partner or do you want, like, you know, a trophy, basically?
He doesn't even say partner. I think
I'm saying,
like,
that's the implication.
Yeah,
there.
That's the implication.
Yes,
the way they
message
it.
Language.
Yeah.
The way she just presents it is like, do you want a real human being or do you want, like, a trophy wife?
Yeah. And that's when she takes it. And she's like, do you want this? And she takes her gummy. Or
you can get with this or you can get with that.
I know. But then she turns back around and looks all made up again like before. And then Kirk reveals, oh, that was placebo. You didn't actually take anything.
Quite a woman, eh, Childress?
A fake. By a drug.
By herself. She took no drug.
I swallowed it.
Colored gelatin.
Yes, they took away my drug and substituted that.
But that can't be.
There's only one kind of woman.
Or man, for that matter.
You either believe in yourself or you don't.
It's just your confidence.
And then they're straight up just like, it's actually just your how much confidence you have in yourself and how you carry yourself.
That's some bullshit. I'm just going to say, that's some bullshit.
I mean, she literally has a... I mean, I took I like the messaging in some of it. And I'm willing to take a grain of salt with, okay, the audience needs to believe. Like, when in the Lord of the Rings, when they describe Gandalf as getting bigger and more imposing, and then in the movies they show him as, like, this massive thing, and it's like, oh, is this, you're just trying to illustrate what this might feel like, maybe, to a hobbit.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with the idea that, like, hey, believing in yourself and being confident in yourself is good and, like, will make other people... You know, like, there are people who feed on that. It's the part where they represent that with her looks.
Mm-hmm. Like, exactly.
Like,
the same.
Her, like, beauty returning that used to be from a drug. Like, that.
That's, you gotta believe.
Where, that's the part where it gets a little skeezy.
Yeah. I mean, this whole episode is definitely on the skeezy side.
Yeah.
I
like,
would
again,
say.
When the credits came up and I saw the Roddenberry, the story credit, I was like, yep, of course.
Mm-hmm. So he picks the partner. He wants somebody who knows how to get his food off of the pans in a dust storm. And I don't know. The whole thing ending with, like, oh, were they really just looking for husbands the whole time? I honestly thought for a lot, like, this, for up until that part, I really thought there was some, like, energy siphoning, or they're in on it with Mud for the money or something like that. And, like, I guess they really did just want to settle down, and you're going to settle down with this dick on this dust planet?
Yeah,
right.
I mean, the other two women barely get any lines of dialogue. Like, their characters,
they're often married.
Motivations are not super well developed.
Yeah, and like, it kind of just ends there with then Mud being like, so am I off the hook? And they're like, no, you're going to jail.
Yeah.
No.
Bare minimum. I mean, I'll put it in a good word for you, but we're definitely dropping you off at a starbase, and you're definitely getting arrested.
And I don't know what happens to the rest of the... Oh, it gets confiscated. The Venus drug, he said, is confiscated. I was going to say, you don't know what happens to it, but he does say it's confiscated. I don't know. These two episodes, I had a really good time with our previous two episodes.
Yes.
Especially the naked time. But even Where No Man Has Gone Before, I enjoyed. These two, I actually fell asleep during Mud's Women and had to watch. Like, it was a kind of long and drawn out, and just a lot of, like, soft focus shots of people.
It's long and drawn out for what feels like a very foregone conclusion by the time they get around to what the actual conclusion is. Like, it makes you think of, like, there's something more going on than there actually is, but it takes forever to reveal that. And then it just kind of keeps going even after they reveal that.
Yeah, like, there's a lot of time spent with just like, oh, the crew is beguiled. You know, like,
right.
there's just so much time spent there that, kind of like you said, Brad, you're just left wondering constantly, like, what's the bigger picture here? Are they just, is just this the 60s creeping up again, or is there something going on here? And I think, like you said, Alex, it winds up just being a little bit of both. Like, oh, yeah. It just, because I think McCoy at some point even talks to Kirk and is like, hey man, are these the most beautiful women we've ever seen, or is there something else going on here? And he's like, I don't really know. He's like, are they? We've seen a lot of people, so it's just.
Can we do a bro check here? Can you just let me know? Am I seeing what I think I'm seeing?
But also, one of the women walks by the scanner and it goes off, the medical scanner, and it starts off in a weird way.
That's never really explained.
And he's like, are you wearing radioactive perfume or something? It's just like, no, it's just me.
I mean, something about the Venus drug, I think, is supposed to have, like, an external effect on the things around it. But, like, it's never very clearly defined what that even is.
Also, why doesn't Mud take it? Like, does he also
He doesn't
not...
mean to. Look at him.
I guess
look at
so.
That dude.
This is what the...
He's got that chest hair. He's got that earring. That guy is fucking drowning in women. You just
yeah, that,
know it.
That actor is having fun in that role for sure.
Well, this is what peak performance looks like.
What peak masculinity looks like.
He already took it. That's what happens if you take it. He looks like a normal person before he took it.
Yeah, if a man starts taking those drugs, basically your entire body hair just becomes pubes.
These are two famous episodes, right?
Yes. I mean, for varying reasons. Like, Enemy Within very much because of the Kirk stuff. Like, it is some of the best Kirk face acting anywhere in the series. And this one, because it is the first Harry Mudd episode. And while, again, like I said, he is not a constant character that shows up all the time, he is a character, one of the few characters that recurs throughout the series, so.
Okay. Because, on its face, I would say Mudd's Women You know, taking aside the way, you know, the role of the women are portrayed in the whole thing, even taking that aside, I thought just the pacing was slow.
I think this is the worst episode of the ones we've watched so far.
Yeah. It was just slow. Just kind of like plot wise, it felt plotting in a lot of ways to get to the reveal, which was just like kind of like Brad said, the Dumbo feather of like, it was you all along. Mm-hmm. It was like, okay, all right.
But anyway, within, you know, look, I it definitely has some elements that have aged extremely poorly. But again, if you just want to see William Shatner doing the William Shatner thing at 11 on all the different dials,
yeah,
this episode is that.
Yeah, if you want to see McCoy say he's dead, Jim, about a dog in a Halloween unicorn suit. I had seen that shot of Spock holding the dog before, mm-hmm. So I'm glad a lot of when that stuff drops into place and I get to see it in context, like Sulu doing the fencing stuff and him holding the dog here. And I had heard about Mudd's women, and like we were playing that Star Trek game, and I think Harry Mudd is in it, where
yes,
we're up
is.
To on that Star Trek game. So, man. What a weird show.
Kind of weird.
It's weird. We have not seen the full extent of its weirdness yet. We have maybe seen...
I started skipping ahead, not watching, but just like flipping through the episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Like the kind of descriptions and a thumbnail, and yeah, there's some stuff.
Oh, there's some stuff.
I made it up to the episode where Khan is introduced, and then I got excited.
How many episodes are in this season?
20-something?
29 total in this season. The other two are more like 24.
Okay. Yeah, I'm in for what's going on. I just like I said, I think Mudd's Women was just a little slow for me in compared to what else has been going on. Anyway, within I really enjoyed, except for the part where
once again Yeoman Rand is treated like shit.
Not only treated like shit, it was actually really uncomfortable. The Yeoman Rand in the interrogation part of being like this happened, and you know them being like, well. Look at me. Yeah. You know, nothing happened. It's just
the scene in her quarters was very uncomfortable and unpleasant. Like the part where Kirk is like, it wasn't me, and kind of doesn't even pay lip service to like what she just went through. Like I was willing to go with it for a while because he's like half a person there. But then the part where they just like laugh it off at the end without addressing it at all was like, okay, show.
Yeah, that's pretty tough. That is aged poorly, but I don't even know if it ever aged poorly. It might've been poor at the time, let's say. But it is, you know, aside from that, there's some, like, the dog, I actually like Sulu getting some screen time, even if he's just freezing most of the time, and the hamming it up with the body double stuff was fun, at least.
It's like I said, Star Trek is a series of very high highs and extremely low lows, so, you know, it's going to be a roller coaster ride as we go through this series, but I think the highs are definitely worth it, so.
Yeah. I'm curious how Mudd's Women, at the time, like people, the person I know has passed away that watched a lot of Star Trek at the time and really liked it as a progressive show. So I can't ask her, but like was it looked on at the time as like, oh, okay, this is like an empowering thing, in the context of TV for women, or was it looked like on as like, what the fuck? That's garbage.
Yeah.
Give her a ship. Give her own ship and let her get out of there.
Well, what I can tell you is now, it's definitely looked on as, what the fuck?
Yeah, well, that's, yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Well, now that those two are in the books, in 2 weeks, we will be heading over to episode 7 and 8, which are What Are Little Girls Made Of? Which is a rare Nurse Chapel-focused episode.
Okay.
And Miri, which is an episode, if it's the one I'm remembering correctly, is definitely testing the limits of what kind of makeup you could do on television in 1966.
Okay.
So we will be doing those in 2 weeks. However, next week, we will be returning to our movie side of the podcast and continuing our adventures through submarine films with 1995's Crimson Tide. The Tony Scott thriller. I'm very excited about this one. I've not seen it in a while, but I remember loving this movie. Some great Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington scenery chewing acting in this one. And once again, I do believe we will be joined by the one and only Drew Scanlon to talk through that film. So look for that next week. for now. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching and all that fun stuff. Vinny, Brad, thank you as always.
Thank you.
And we will see you next time on the Next Lander Watchcast.